Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of vanityfair.com, and I'm here with three people. It's so exciting. There's Mike Hogan, Vanity Fair's digital director.
Hey, everybody.
Richard Lawson, Vanity Fair's film critic.
Hello.
And here in New York is Joanna Robinson, Vanity Fair's senior writer.
Well, hello.
This is a really monumental occasion. We are all in the same room together. We can make eye contact. It's thrilling.
Not only that, noted podcaster Joanna Robinson said she's never been in a room with other people podcasting before.
Man.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what are your weird podcast habits that you now can't do in front of us? Like, petting your kitten is one of them.
No, it's the whole icon. I feel like I feel very, you know, socially anxious right now. I usually don't, but I'm like, oh, there's eye contact to make while I'm talking.
Don't worry. We don't make eye contact.
Okay,
we're going to stare at the table.
We're going to learn a lot about each other. Well, it's a big week. There's a lot going on awards buzz-wise that we wanted to catch up on, so it's kind of a nice time to all be in one room. So we're going to talk about the New York and Los Angeles Film Critics Association Awards. We're going to talk about Richard's top 10 list and also Golden Globe predictions, since those come out next Monday between this and the next episode. But we have to start with kind of a down note, but something that really needs to get addressed. I think a listener on Twitter was asking us if we were going to talk about the allegations against Casey Affleck, who is the star of Manchester by the Sea. We've talked about his odds of winning Best Actor several times, but he does have a sexual assault allegation in his past, which is unfortunately becoming common for people in the public eye. And Mike, you've kind of done the most research, I think, on what exactly he's been accused of. Can you kind of run down what Casey Affleck has been accused of and then maybe why we're not talking about it enough?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to go too deep into it. There's a pretty good Daily Beast article that's comprehensive, but it's two women who worked on I'm Still Here, the Joaquin Phoenix mockumentary where he sort of pretended, sort of did give up acting to become a rapper, which was problematic in itself. This may go down as one of the more problematic. I was going to say most problematic, but we've got Last Tango in Paris and a lot of other contenders.
Yeah, what a week.
One of the rather problematic productions of all time. But apparently the behavior on the set was completely bananas. And Casey was doing all kinds of things from physically pushing himself onto these women to sending them really nasty text messages to encouraging a male cast member to show his private parts to them. And basically just acting like a huge jerk and maybe worse, according to these allegations. So the ways that Casey Affleck responded to this were when they first complained, he kind of started attacking them. Then later after they sued him, he vehemently denied everything. Then he went into arbitration and settled everything. And I think everything was sealed.
Yeah, we have
lawsuits you can see, but no one's talked about
it. We haven't heard from the woman who accused him since any of this happened.
And then he did the sort of classic thing when somebody brought it up more recently in an email to just say, well, you know, it's just sad when you're famous, people can say anything about you. And I wish they wouldn't do that because we are human beings with families. So, you know, it's hard to imagine two non-famous people working in a business as relationship-driven as Hollywood making crazy accusations against their much more powerful and famous director just for the sake of it, for fun or whatever that would be, for money. But you never know. Why are we not talking about it? One, I don't think people were super aware of it. It was kind of one of these things where I had this notion in the back of my mind like, oh, right, Casey Affleck did some shady thing that I can't quite exactly remember, but boy, am I in love with this movie, you know, and you do kind of push it out of your head. Secondly, he plays a completely screwed up monster in the movie. And so I don't know. There's part of me that's kind of like, well, maybe he's just a screwed up monster, but still a really good performance. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there is probably structural racism coming into play versus the way that the Birth of a Nation thing has been dealt with. I would like to point out that I said at the time that people should see Birth of a Nation, even though I felt that, you know, whatever you think about Nate Parker. So, you know, I think you should still see Manchester by the Sea. I still think it's a great performance. And, you know, he's an actor. He's not the director. This isn't his entire passion project. He's not the sole responsible person for this thing. And it's not claiming to sort of make a huge stand against important issues of our time. Still, there's something about handing a guy a golden statuette and everybody cheering and saying how great they are and them being enshrined in the Pantheon, where there is a kind of, you know, Richard and I were talking about this yesterday, like, you don't want to morally audit every single, to use your great phrase, every single person who's up for any award. But on the other hand, do you really want to reward? It's tricky.
It is tricky. And I think that some of the frustration comes from a kind of deeper level. It's a frustration with the industry where it's not how dare an audience member like Casey Affleck in this movie. It goes further back. It's like, why would he be hired in the first place? And then kind of put him in a position to be giving a good performance that people like and that people give awards to.
Or even if he's hired, are we really going to celebrate him as the pinnacle of achievement in this field without really resolving what the hell happened? And at least Nate Parker came out and spoke at least semi-forthrightly about this whole thing and apologize. Casey has basically thus far been like, these crazy people attack me for no reason, which, again, it's possible, it's true. It seems to me rather unlikely.
It seems at least that Casey Affleck needs to reckon with this in some way that forwards the conversation. I think that's an unintentional positive that came out of the Nate Parker thing, is that it really forwarded the conversation. But it seems unlikely if, in that email that you mentioned, Mike, if that was recent, then it seems like anything that he might say on the subject now that might be more meditative or, you know, allowing for mistakes made would seem like it was done just as part of the award season game.
Just to win an Oscar, he actually acknowledges the reality of sexual assault.
Yeah. Well, and then tactically, the fact that Nate Parker did try to be forthright and got completely annihilated and erased from the entire conversation.
Like, he did all these apology tours but kept not really apologizing. He didn't thread the needle, which is a really hard needle to thread. But
it is a hard needle to thread, and you'd have to be semi-hubristic to think you could thread it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just, you don't know where the landmines are, frankly.
Well, Richard, you were voting with the New York Film Critics Circle last week, and we were going to talk about this later, but Casey Affleck won the Best Actor Award. Did any of this come up in that conversation in the room?
I'm not really supposed to talk about what happened behind the scenes, as it were, during the voting. But I can say from my perspective, you know, as much as I like Manchester by the Sea and much as I think that Casey Affleck is great in it, I wasn't thrilled to have him win. Because of this. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not because he's not great in the movie. It's just, I think that right now, given the political tenor of this country, I just think that, like, any sort of tacit endorsements that we are giving in whatever kind of silly context, like, you know, critics awards, to this kind of behavior, to this kind of, frankly, white male entitlement, I'm just not thrilled to be doing that, you know. Yeah. And I think on a purely artistic level, if we are ever able to assess something like this in a vacuum, he's great in it. And so I think that that's sort of how the group I voted with went, because he is really good in it. But personally, I'm unable to shut out the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of whether or not you can separate the art from the artist is, like, it comes up over and over again. It's come up with Roman Polanski and Woody Allen for decades. And it just seems like it's a really personal thing. Like, you kind of have the choice of whether or not to do it. But then it comes down to the personal choices of 5,000 Academy members and whether or not they're going to do that. And there just doesn't seem to be any evidence based on what we've seen so far that they're going to consider any of this. And Casey Affleck will kind of cruise through because he's already famous.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You think it's going to come up?
No, I mean, the fact that this is bubbling up.
Hopefully.
Now, and sorry to say, but if you're in one of the rival camps, you're going to be saying from now till January 30th or whatever the deadline is, like, sure, he's great in it, but did you read that Daily Beast article? Have you heard whatever else is going to come out about it? I mean, people negatively campaign. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, and as it bubbles in, like, podcasts and that sort of stuff, it's going to work its way to the point where if you're a journalist and you have a sit down with Casey Affleck and you don't ask him about this, it seems out of line, and there's no way that Casey Affleck can zoom through the rest of award season and not give lengthy interviews.
I don't really understand how it hasn't come up, because that Daily Beast article was published.
There's been an interesting strategy with Affleck in that in a lot of interviews he's been with his brother or with Matt Damon, and it kind of, it protects him, and I think it creates a kind of collegial environment during these interviews. Mm-hmm. And
well,
so
you like Matt Damon. You don't, kind of, yeah. you don't want to make Matt Damon uncomfortable.
And it's a bit like showing up to, you know, your dinner in Little Italy with like a couple guys on your side, you know, like it's protection, you know, and I think that that's not an accident at all.
I would say one more thing that's interesting about this and the Last Tango in Paris controversy, where Bernardo Bertolucci said something along the lines of he and Brando surprised Maria Schneider with some aspect of that infamous rape scene, whether it was full on, she didn't know any of it was going to happen, or the whole butter thing. I hate myself for even talking about this. But in that case, and in I'm Still Here, it seems to me that there's an old fashioned macho pushing the limits of art. You know, it reminds me also of that story we did about Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep,
mm-hmm. where Dustin, Kramer versus Kramer.
On Kramer versus Kramer, where Dustin Hoffman was probably acting like a huge asshole for the role, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a methody thing.
Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting moment as we all sort of get woke and as people's voices start to get louder and they say, like, you know, just because you think you're doing method and that is going to help the film, don't sexually harass me. Don't sexually assault me.
Yeah.
That isn't an excuse for everything. I think that's a change to the Hollywood value system.
Yeah.
You know, I think that these guys have felt entitled to do whatever it took for the art. And I think it's an important moment for people to be like, that's not part of the deal here. Like, yeah, that's not what we come here for.
I think there's a line between that I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn, a line between, you know, Tom Hardy being a jerk to Leonardo DiCaprio on the set of The Revenant because they're in character as adversaries and sexually harassing a woman. Like, that is a huge yeah. difference. And I think for a long time, Hollywood has operated as if they're not that different because they're all in the service of the art.
And why are you sexually harassing the director of photography? But
yeah, that's not part of your performance.
But if the entire experiment was, let's make a crazy film where reality isn't reality and everything we do is sort of in character yeah. and we'll see what comes yeah. of it. Like, I suspect that's possible that that's part of what happened here. I have no idea. And I don't yeah. want to make excuses for anybody either. But yeah. I wonder if that's part
of it.
You
can kind of do that and cross layer boundaries, but there are still people working there who want to feel safe.
Well, there never
job.
Seems yeah. to be that much consideration for the actress's art. You know,
no.
it's like, oh right. just get out of the way of my fucking thing. And, yeah. and I don't know, you can figure it out, you know, on your own. It's like, this is a collaboration, and to alienate somebody in whatever way you're doing it, whether they're a performer or a crew member or whatever, you're impeding the project because you're making it worse.
Well,
for, you know,
I would say, in fairness to a deeply problematic and I think outdated point of view, it's about antagonizing somebody else to see what they come out with.
Right.
And it's yeah. supposed to be a two-way street. I think yeah. the issue is that it doesn't adequately take into account that it doesn't feel like
well,
a two-way street.
And they're, you know, power dynamics,
dynamics.
If it's a yeah. male yeah. director and a male star, you know. But anyway, I think that some conflict and some struggle in art is valuable and worth it and creates really good things. But certainly, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. And, like, it's just a movie. Like, maybe let's yeah. try to make everyone have a decent experience, you know.
Yeah. yeah.
It's so interesting that you talk about the larger concept of entitlement, because, you know, Katie brings up Matt Damon as a likable shield for Casey Affleck, but even Matt Damon, right, is bumping up against his new role in The Great Wall. There was controversy around whitewashing The Great Wall, and it's fine if that controversy was overblown, but for Matt Damon to brush it off without acknowledging the larger anxiety around it.
Especially in light of the Project
Greenlight.
Greenlight.
Yeah. yeah, right off the Project Greenlight. It just seems like Matt Damon, who we do like, who is so likable, who isn't like a sort of nasty kind of entitlement, but just sort of this attitude of like, I don't understand your concern.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a nice guy and I care about diversity, which I think he does. But there's just like a larger, yeah, way in which, as Mike says, the wokeness of the rest of us is trickling down to this industry.
Yeah.
So, Mike, you, I feel like you hear from a lot of publicists and people who are kind of planting ideas. Like, if you're working at Paramount and you're promoting Denzel Washington in Fences, for example, as a Best Actor contender, what do you do to kind of keep this going in the conversation? What do you think they're planning at Paramount right now? You know, backing Tom Hanks and Sully or any other, you know, fellow Best Actor contender?
I don't think the studios do much coordinated, planned negative campaigning.
Unless you're Harvey Weinstein.
I think it's possible that some of the independent producers are more willing to go there.
Yeah.
I think that the awards consultants have ways of doing it that's just a conversation. They're not going to like plant. I mean, they might. They're talking to journalists a lot and mm-hmm. they're going, I know it's a great performance, but like, I'm going to have to read that thing. Like,
yeah.
what do you think? You know, do you think that that's okay? It's just planting the seed. And by the way, since they're journalists, they're going to be like, well, let me go look into this. By the way, that didn't happen here. What happened here was a person on Twitter who I don't know what their motivation was, but presumably just were bothered by this story, saying to us, like, you guys are talking about Casey Affleck like he's the second coming.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that was a good point. But, yeah. but you mm-hmm. know, whatever the context is, that's going to keep happening and people are going to keep examining their conscience.
Yeah.
You know?
And I would encourage other listeners, if these kind of things come up, tweet at us, let us know.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah, I'm glad that this came up.
So, Richard, as we mentioned before, you voted with the New York Film Critics Circle last week. You can't talk about what went down in the room where it happens because, you know, secret ballots and all.
It is secret. And, you know, I should clarify with the Casey Affleck thing. It was a thrill to do this, and I am happy with pretty much all the winners. And I think, you know, again, in that vacuum, Casey Affleck is great. So I'm not trying to come down on my fellow Critics Circle members' vote.
But I think there's something with being part of any group that votes on awards. Not every one of your favorites is going to win every award.
No. Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you this. No one I voted for first won anything. So I was clearly not in step with.
But we have seen your top 10 movies of the year.
Yeah, the Mendler
just
didn't take off in the room.
I really stump for that thing. As much as you can stump when you're just writing things down on a little piece of paper. And, but no, it was really exciting. And I think one of the most intriguing things about the whole process was, you know, if you were to publish a list of every film that got one vote, you know, at least one vote during the whole 4-hour thing. It's an incredible list.
Yeah.
I mean, just a breadth of, and you know, I was sitting next to Amy Taubin, this great kind of lion of film criticism, who, you know, at almost 80 years old, still traverses the ice and snow at Sundance every year. And she's just a real treat to get to know. And she was throwing out these really fascinating choices. And so many, I mean, you know, as much as I knew who anyone was voting for, because it was, again, actually kept pretty well secret. It was exciting to kind of, in my head, build up a mental list of movies I hadn't seen this year.
Sure.
Sunset Song or Sandstorm or lots of kind of smaller titles that someone in the room, at least one person, liked.
Well, I'm glad you didn't walk in there with like the standard issue Oscar picks, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be pretty boring and pointless.
No, it didn't feel, I mean, I think that the way the awards ended up panning out with who won, it was a little bit more kind of centrist, maybe, let's
sure.
say, that than I was expecting. But but you know, these are, the New York Film Critics Circle sort of oscillates back and forth. Some years are really out there, Kristen Stewart winning or whatever, and some years are more in line with how we think the Academy Awards are going to shake out. So
yeah.
I didn't get any sense during the process that all of this was sort of preordained.
So can you run down just real quick the big winners?
Oh, yeah. So Casey Affleck won Best Actor. Best Actress went, unsurprisingly, to Isabelle Huppert for both Elle and Things to Come.
Now, you say unsurprisingly, but, you know, when we talk about who's in, like, the thick of the Best Actress race, like, we keep talking about Emma Stone, Natalie Portman, and maybe Annette Bening.
Yeah.
But Isabelle Huppert is really emerging as the critics' favorite in this last week, I think.
Well, I mean, you've met New York film critics. I just think Isabelle Huppert was clearly, you know, I think people were so enamored of both of her movies this year and of her. And, you know, I think that, you know, because she's never won an Oscar, never been nominated for an Oscar, it's a kind of honor in a way to be a smaller critics group that says, oh, no, Ms. Huppert, like, here, like, you are loved. And, you know, she's going to come to our awards dinner, you know, in January. So,
and you have the ability to award someone for multiple films, which is not something
And, you know, I think that after the winners were announced, because Michelle Williams won Best Supporting Actress for Manchester by the Sea and Certain Women. And so there were some people on Twitter saying, well, look, the two actresses who won for two films where the men won for one. So it's just proof that women have to do twice as much work. And I see that point and I take that point. But I also say, well, it also just means Michelle Williams and Isabelle Huppert had great years. You know, they did really...
They got twice as much work.
Right. I think it's kind of a glass half full, half empty kind of thing. But yeah, we were able to do that. And I think that both of those actresses just, I mean, they're great this year. So it's exciting.
I mean, what's interesting looking at the awards, you know, not having been in the room, is you see a lot of attention going to Moonlight and then to Manchester by the Sea with Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams winning. And then La La Land won Best Picture, which is really fascinating to see.
Yeah.
I mean, we were recording last week while you were in this deliberation and talking about La La Land as kind of a populist pick compared to Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea. But if it's a critic's pick too, like, I mean, it kind of feels unstoppable now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that no matter how you look at it, it's a boon for that movie and its campaign. And, you know, I think that it was a surprise. I mean, certainly judging by Twitter's reaction, because, you know, the awards were announced on Twitter, on this one publicist Twitter account, very slowly over the course of 4 hours. And then, you know, Moonlight won for director and cinematography and supporting actor, and Manchester won awards for its acting, you know. And it was just seemed kind of like, well, it's going to be Moonlight or it's going to be Manchester. And then out of nowhere, La La Land. So, yeah, I think it's fun to have a surprise there, you know, at the end.
And I think that's exactly what we talked about last week, is that Manchester and Moonlight, the way we saw the race last week was that they were likely to pick up the acting awards and other awards, and that La La Land would take the big prize.
Yeah. As like the Academy would be like, oh, well, we gave him these things, so we'll give it Best Picture.
Right.
And then the New York critics were doing that, that as we were speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, then the Los Angeles critics voted on Sunday, and they had Moonlight as their top pick, but with the runner-up La La Land. They didn't go for the hometown favorite in that case.
Not to like start any sort of, you know, East Coast, West Coast battle, but you know, the LA Film Critics Association does have the benefit of going after New York, so they can kind of see what New York goes with, and then maybe, I don't know, maybe that affects, maybe it doesn't. I mean, I know and like many, many people in that group, so I don't want to question their motives.
Well, but, they also managed to make out-of-the-box choices every year, and having been
which
in
I think
the room
is great.
With critics groups voting, I don't totally understand how they do it. They must have a period of like stumping for something, because you get something like Lily Gladstone of Certain Women winning Best Supporting Actress, which is a great choice. She's great in that movie. But if you have just the sheer process of everyone going around putting their picks, she's not.
How the heck does that happen?
I don't even totally understand. I mean, it's great that they get to highlight things. You know, The Handmaiden won Best Production Design, and Rebecca Hall and Christine was the runner up for Best Actress. Like, they're highlighting fantastic performances. But it's just, I truly don't understand how it happens. If you're a LAFCA member listening, please call us.
Yeah, if you're allowed to talk about your process, because having now been through the New York critics process, that again, I'm not speaking of, I'm very curious, exactly like you said, Katie, like how, I mean, I'm so glad that Lily Gladstone and whoever else got in there, but like, how did that happen?
Yeah, Adam Driver really and Patterson won Best Actor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's really cool.
I think that's what critics groups really should do, is really highlighting stuff like that, like not just checking off the boxes of what you think is going to win Oscars.
Yeah, well, the last thing you want is for everyone to be competing to predict the Oscars.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's
right.
No fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't ever, I mean, I think we do kind of judge on that basis, and we shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a member of the group that votes on the Critics' Choice Awards, which every year feels like it does that exact same thing. And the nominees, there's some really great nominees in that group that we were talking about last week. But most years it winds up being like, oh, well, who's going to win Best Actress? I'm going that seems what people do, no matter how.
Right. Because they don't want to be wrong.
Well, it's such a large group that, you know, if the everything kind of merges toward the most mainstream thing, like, you're probably going to wind up being close to what everyone's talking about.
Yeah.
I guess it's just so funny. Last year, well, previous years, I just remember narratives building up around Patricia Arquette or J.K. Simmons because of the critics. Like, I always feel like the critics are anticipating or creating the momentum that we see, but maybe they're reacting to momentum that they hear. That you, like, being part of this podcast is interesting to me, to hear how much you guys know before the rest of us know, having talked to people who are in the Academy, you know, and publicists. So you already know the narrative. And then the narrative can be expressed through Critics' Choice, and then the rest of us hear that narrative, and then it gets reflected back again in the nominations.
I think the critics get to solidify a narrative. Like, if somehow the critics had seen Moonlight and been like, ah, you know what, we like whatever better, like, Moonlight would be dead. Like, that would be it for it in Oscars. Because it's getting the critical support continued, I think it gets to continue to be part of the conversation.
Yeah.
So there's a role that critics play in this that's really massive.
Well, remember early on when we all first saw Moonlight, I guess in Toronto or right after Toronto, right?
Telluride.
Yeah. Okay. Hello.
Excuse me.
Richard saw it in Telluride, and the rest of the world
of
saw
feet
it
up in the air.
Oh,
in Toronto.
This is in person, like, Richard face that I don't so good.
But remember, I remember saying I could really see it being a number 9 Best Picture nominee. You know, so then you start to see these critic awards start to say, like, oh no, it's a number 2 or 3, or could be even be 1. You know, like, there's a chance. And we can start to see this narrative of, like, oh, the 2 tearjerkers split between Moonlight and Manchester, and La La Land sails through on the strength of being, like, relatively sunny.
Yeah. Well, and last year,
we don't know. We're still more time.
Last year, I made a bet that Spotlight couldn't win Best Picture because it was a critical favorite, and then, like, it just didn't seem like it could make it through. But then, the more that critical drumbeat goes, the more it just has the power to win.
I was speaking with a new friend who is a member of the Academy. I won't say her name, but
Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah, I'm learning my French. I was in Paris this weekend.
La La Land. Yeah, I love it.
But she's kind of convinced that Manchester's going to pull a Spotlight and win.
Oh.
This is Susan Sarandon, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was me, Jill Stein, and Susan were at dinner.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie's like, I liked Manchester.
We were in a little restaurant in Harrisburg after she filed the Pennsylvania recount thing.
Jill Stein has great Oscar opinions.
Yeah.
Well, can I take an opening here just to talk about Manchester for one second, because there was a little bit of a hot take about how you shouldn't watch it. And I really passionately believe that that is an erroneous
You shouldn't view. Watch it because of Casey Affleck?
Because of Casey Affleck, because it's just some annoying white straight guy and his miserable problems. Oh. It's like, come on, you know, like, watch this movie.
White
it's so well assembled. It's so well written. It really needs to win Best Screenplay. You know, Kenny Lonergan is such an accomplished guy. I watched Moonlight in Manchester back to back, unfortunately, for the second time on Sunday. But Manchester just holds up unbelievably well on the second.
But that's what I'm saying. See Moonlight and Manchester. I mean, I know not everyone has time to see all the movies, but like, see Manchester, but definitely see Moonlight and definitely see Fences. Like,
no, don't see Moonlight, actually. No, I'm kidding. Yes, of course.
You know, but like, that's the thing. It's like, that I never think is the answer. Like, oh, don't go see this movie because it's about a straight white guy's angst. It's like, yes, I want more diverse stories out there, but there are some great options in this award season. And I don't think you should ignore a story just because it, yeah, because it is a straight white guy. I mean,
well, if it's a good so, it's movie so good. About straight white guy angst, then, you know.
The
well,
push yeah. for diversity is not get rid of all straight white guy stories. It's like have stories about everyone.
As much well, as Breitbart might try to convince us that that's true.
And not to harp on all this, but maybe even just to clarify a little bit more about, I think, The Birth of a Nation, what happened there. Because it's weird when you're doing predictions. And I have my predictions up on Gold Derby, which are all going to be totally wrong. But it's a mix of like advocating and just trying to read the tea leaves, you know, with Birth of a Nation, which I thought was flawed, but pretty good movie and very powerful movie. It's absent from almost everybody's predictions, not necessarily because they think that it should be punished for whatever Nate Parker has done, but because between all the shitty press and the bad box office and the fact that no one can figure out how to defend it at Fox Searchlight, it's dead in the water. You know, whereas right. I think Manchester, even if it ends up that Casey Affleck gets a nomination, but Denzel wins or something because people just don't feel comfortable pulling that lever, this movie has momentum and yeah. is a real going concern now. And whether there's racism playing into that, I don't know. But I mean, it's Kenny Lonergan's movie.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Nate Parker is so bound up with Birth of a Nation and his writing partner, you mm-hmm. know, I think it hurt them that way.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
But we're talking about cementing momentum and the Golden Globes nominations next week.
Yeah, on Monday.
Are there possibilities that would kill momentum? Like, imagine if La La Land didn't get nominated for Best Comedy oh Musical.
But of course it will.
There's like, that would be comedy like the, exists comedy for musical, La La Land. Yeah.
That would be the Trump winning of...
Oh my God. You know, the Golden Globes are so unpredictable. And we always have to note that the membership of the Golden Globes is not the membership of the Academy at all. So kind of treating them as Oscar predictors is foolish.
It's a few
but
dozen
also,
foreign journalists
yeah,
alleged.
Yeah, we'll have our Golden Globes rants, I'm sure, plenty of times throughout the season. But there is a momentum factor because it's this huge televised ceremony that gives you a chance to see how cute Emma Stone is accepting an award, etc. I mean, I think looking at what we think are the possibilities, like if you see Hell or High Water showing up among the drama nominees, like that could be a really mm-hmm. interesting momentum builder. You know, Jackie is an interesting thing because it didn't do as well at the Critics' Choice nominations as I thought it would. I think Natalie Portman is definitely a lock, but the movie itself seems to be kind of on the bubble for being arty or, you know, not great, as some people might argue
camp,
that it is not.
I believe is the word that was used.
Hey, Richard used camp in his assessment of it, naming it the seventh best movie
of the
year. Oh
yeah, Richard, we cruised right past your top 10 list, but
I just looked, it just went up, and I already got one kudos for naming The Meddler the number one best film of 2016.
From Susan Sarandon.
Which should be...
My dear friend.
In a perfect world, that should be a comedy musical contender for the Golden Globes, for sure, because
sure,
it's such a great comedy.
I would love that.
As well. Yeah. I think that field is so weird.
It's not what the Golden Globes are for the like Florence Foster Jenkins. Americans.
Yeah.
And the, like, you know, to get the comedies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, looking at the comedy, I'm trying to kind of predict what's going to be on there. We're going to have a Golden Globes prediction post on the site. But, you know, you've got Florence Foster Jenkins, 20th Century Women, I think, and La La Land, and then The Lobster, A Sing Street,
that hilarious
Deadpool.
That laugh riot.
Yeah.
Deadpool, that would be shocking.
I mean,
but not.
But would,
like,
it?
The, but, yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people are predicting Rules Don't Apply, which.
Rules Don't Apply, which.
Oh,
which
is that funny?
But it had one of the worst box office openings ever, and yet, I guess, because
Warren
Beatty.
But it's Warren.
Yeah, I mean, and you look in the, like, lead actor in a comedy field, which is truly bizarre, like, you know, Ryan Gosling in La La Land, and then Hugh Grant, Ryan Reynolds. It's really a mystery.
The other prong of the Golden Globes, which we always have to talk about, right, is in addition to the weird and comedy inclusions that we get there, we get those weird film star courting.
Yeah, and yeah, that's the what, tourist problem is what we call it.
Exactly,
this.
Yeah. And that's what why Warren Beatty seems like.
Yeah.
He'd be in.
And well, Annette's already going to be there for 20th Century Women, so, like, you don't have to nominate Warren to get him there, though. I don't know.
It'd be polite, I
think. Well, the Golden Globes also famously love Emily Blunt, so, you know, she could get nominated for A Girl on the Train. Like, there are weird things happen, guys.
Wow.
I just want to encourage you to predict this.
Do you think there's any chance I could get a nomination?
You know, if you go, if you hosted a dinner for the Hollywood Foreign Press, like, maybe.
All right, well, you should figure that
this
next
podcast.
Year we're going to start a thing and, like, get Richard a Golden Globe nomination for anything.
For
we'll just figure out how to do it.
Video, just record the podcast and give it a little qualifying round.
Yeah, yeah,
there you go. Best comedy musical.
There you go.
But this year you can go with definitely Susan Sarandon's Plus One or Isabelle
Huppert.
Yeah. You'll have two choices, really.
Well, I like you sitting between the two of them.
Yes.
Well, if she's nominated for drama and Susan Sarandon's nominated for comedy, I'll just kind of alternate.
Yes.
Yeah. Joanna, do you want to talk about TV real quick? Because the Golden Globes nominations can be really different from the Emmys, and there's all kinds of stuff eligible for Golden Globes that wasn't for the Emmys. Is it going to be real weird?
I don't know how weird it's going to be. Downton Abbey, which has been a perennial favorite, is no longer eligible.
Oh, I didn't realize
so
that.
So I think the big thing that a lot of people see sweeping up is Westworld, which just ended its run. A lot of experts have it in Best Drama, and certainly nominations for Evan Rachel Wood, Tandy Newton, Anthony Hopkins, like all sorts of things.
Does the fact that it's, I think I just read something yesterday that it's a big ratings hit, like I think one of the most watched HBO shows in a long time.
Right.
Does that, do you think that affects that at all? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially when it comes to the Globes, I think. And then the other, not too surprising, but the Globes do like to hit network shows, and so This Is Us, which has been a hit on NBC. A lot of people are seeing that in the Best Drama category.
I've been wondering about Stranger Things and The Crown, which are like the two buzzy Netflix shows
of the
year.
The Crown, definitely.
Yeah.
And Stranger
The HFPA is like certainly going to be in The Crown.
They're like, they'd give it to a corgi if they could.
Who from The Crown? Would it, John Lithgow and Claire Foy?
Definitely, I think.
I would like to see Vanessa Kirby in there, but I don't know.
Oh, she's so good. I think Claire Foy has a real shot at the Globe. But Stranger Things, Winona Ryder's name is coming up a lot, actually, in that same category, which is just so weird to pitch Winona Ryder's performance against Claire Foy's performance.
I want Barb to win.
Yes,
Justice for Barb.
But yeah, Stranger Things, I mean, I'm seeing everyone predict that, and it's such an odd thing to me in a Best Drama of 2016.
I mean, the Globes are, they're right after New Year's. It's like kicking off this two-month crazy period of awards. The weirder they get, the happier I am.
But, you know, it seemed like Stranger Things coming out when it did was a challenge for it Emmy-wise, but if it has a strong showing in the Globes, I think that could keep its momentum.
Yeah, it's not eligible for the Emmys till next September, at which point it will feel like ancient history.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be done with our memes finally by then. Yeah.
But the Globes do like to, HBO and Netflix are like their two favorite things. So if you look at those
And the
shows,
CW, weirdly.
For the breakout actress. It's very curious. And it's an interesting year because it does feel a little bit like the change of the guard. Like House of Cards, which was a perennial favorite, though it's eligible, seems so off the radar. But you never know because the Globes does stuff like Mozart in the Jungle. You know,
what the Globes might do? Sorry, so Mahershala Ali is still on House of Cards, right? He hasn't gotten thrown in front of a train or anything. I stopped watching.
I didn't watch
it. Like, you know, when people win two Golden Globes somehow, like Mahershala Ali could win for supporting actor in film and also for House of Cards.
Kate Winslet did that, right? She won two Golden Globes.
Yeah, Emily Blunt did too, I think.
Yeah.
This keeps happening. So that's my crazy Globes.
Hey, good.
Mahershala Ali wins twice.
I just watched the Variety video series Actors on Actors, and it was Mahershala Ali, and I forget who he was talking to, but he's just the best. I mean, he's so smart and charming and just like handsome, frankly. And, you know, anyway,
he was
so
with
I would.
Greta Gerwig.
Greta Gerwig, that's exactly right. And all she wanted to do was ask him questions. She was like, don't ask me anything. And I, you know, I felt the same way.
Can we get those two in a movie together?
Yes. That would be great.
God.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to go very quickly into our Go Big before we go home because we're getting kicked out of our studio. Supporting actor, Mahershala Ali, I think everyone thinks it's a lock. But then Jeff Bridges keeps showing up for Hell or High Water.
Don't count it out because my dad liked it.
Hey, yeah. So, I mean, who do you guys see winning supporting actor at this point?
I'm going to say it's going to be Mahershala Ali, who also won, you know, at New York Film Critics Circle and just seems to have a momentum behind him. But the real reason I think he's going to win, and this is maybe a little cynical, is that I think Moonlight's going to get nominated for a bunch of things, but it's only going to win that. I think that's going to be its win, basically.
Not even cinematography?
I think it could, but it has a lot of competition there. I think that La La Land, if it sweeps in the bigger categories, like I think it might, the cinematography in La La Land might just kind of get rolled up in
that. We got to do cinematography next week. That's a good category.
Yeah, that is a good category. Anyway, that's what I think.
Or like editing? I feel like Moonlight should win an editing award, but you're probably right. I agree with Richard. I will throw in one wild card, which is if we see the Casey Affleck narrative get more and more dire, a nomination for Lucas Hedges might be an interesting way to talk about Manchester.
Yeah. He's so good.
He's so good. You know, not a win necessarily, but maybe in that category.
So who do you think is going to win?
Marsha.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, I agree. And what's interesting is also if the Casey Affleck narrative goes continually south, you could see African-Americans winning 3 out of the 4 acting awards, Denzel, Viola, and Mahershala.
That would be...
which would be kind of cool.
Exceptionally welcome. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, you know, Ruth Negga gets a nomination for Best Actress for my one-person-loving campaign. She's on the cover of Vogue. That counts for
I don't something. Understand why everyone just like, loving, it's dead, it's dead, it's dead. It's so good. I don't get it.
I know. Well, we'll just keep talking about it. Okay. We'll love our campaign.
It's not dead.
Do you think Mahershala's odds are affected at all by the fact that he's only in 1/3 of the film? I know that's never stopped a Best Supporting Actress before, but...
I mean, it's tough because he's not in the last third. And everyone says, like, if you end it really well, like, you know, Viola's Strongest of Defenses comes near the end, so like kind of concerns you about thinking about her. But I think you don't forget about him in Moonlight. Right. Like, he is such an important part of it.
Also, the fact that, spoiler alert, the main character basically turns into him.
Yeah, you think of him a lot at the end of the movie.
Yeah,
that's true.
Well, you know, my personal desire is that both he and Andre Holland get nominated for Moonlight. And, you know, supporting actor is a weird category. It could totally happen.
But Andre Holland is so good.
I think Mahershala is going to win, but I think that Jeff Bridges winning is the Trump's America possibility. Not that Jeff Bridges is a Trump supporter or anything close to him, but that's like that you think you have something locked down and then something surprising
then comes up. The old,
I think it's a good
point. It would be such a bummer. I mean, nothing against Jeff Bridges. He's great in the movie, but like it would be a real bummer to see that happen for that to be the narrative. And I think Jeff Bridges, you know, for all I know, might know that and know that getting nominated would be fantastic, but it's Mahershala Ali's year. So we'll see how that pans out. That does it for this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. And don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. We appreciate it. It's a great time for people to start listening to understand all these mess of awards. You can find us all at vanityfair.com, writing about award season all the time. And we're on Twitter. We're all at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Joanna.
I'm at Joe Rothis.
Mike.
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard.
Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner. And thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. This week's award for the best way to escape 2016 goes to Richard Lawson.
I'm learning my French. I was in Paris this weekend.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.